You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2015 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the fourth class in a series given by Brother John Launchbury on the subject, The Spirit is Willing, but the Flesh is Weak. This class is titled, I Made a Mighty Beast.
So this is class four, the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. What we did the first class was looked at the idea that we are constituted from spirit and flesh, and then we spent the next 2 days looking at the individual aspects of how do we think about individual flesh, what is it, and then how do we think about being led by spirit, what is that? What we're now going to do is start looking at the notion of flesh collectively, and then ultimately tomorrow, the universal spirit that is God himself. So yes, 2 days ago we saw flesh, or hypothesized that one way to think about flesh is the notion of a feedback loop, a mental feedback loop in our heads with self-image as a key component. And this egoistic thinking leads to a lot of stuff that guides how many things that we do in our lives. And today we're going to look at a similar idea, but with groups of people in mind. And we're going to be touching on issues such as sin and Satan and things like that. So let's just remember, first of all, some of the fundamentals about sin that we know. Because we're going to look at the Satan concept, let's quickly check the foundation. James is really clear, and his teaching aligns very much with Jesus' teaching. Verse 13 for context in James 1, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. Then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So we have evil desire, unclean desire, I think some translation has. This is this egoistic thinking that has builds up a desire loop within us. It drags us away from spirit things. It entices us. Desire is conceived, sin is born, and then finally death is born. One of those beautiful paradoxes. So that's the sin fundamentals. And so now what we're going to do is scale it up a bit. So I'm now not just talking about me or just about you. I'm going to start talking about lots of people all coming together. And I'd like to come to this idea of the dragon that appears in Revelation. Revelation, incredible book, many, many visions, and because it's symbolic, it's open to many interpretations. And indeed, there are many interpretations of the book of Revelation. The distinctions and the details of those aren't relevant for our purposes here. I, years ago, came across a great two-word summary of the book of Revelation, which is actually all you need to know, and it is, Jesus wins. So that's the book of Revelation in two words. One of the symbols, or a repeated kind of symbol that occurs in prophecy throughout Scripture and occurs in Revelation, are beasts. And beasts are typically groups of people and often manifested as nations. So that's all we need to know in terms of the symbology of Revelation and how we'll dig into it. So let's have a look at a couple of passages. Revelation chapter 20, and we have a great dragon. Verse 1 of Revelation 20, I saw an angel coming down out of heaven, having the key to the abyss, and holding in his hand a great chain. He seized the dragon, that ancient serpent who is the devil or Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the abyss, and locked and sealed it over him, to keep him from deceiving the nations any more until the 1,000 years were ended. After that, he must be set free for a short time. Now, this dragon that we are getting here in Revelation 20. It's not the first time he's appeared in Revelation. He is introduced to us in Revelation 12, the same dragon. And it's what we'll do is start again a little bit of context, verse 1 of Revelation 12. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and about to give, and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them into the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. So I know my picture of a dragon has only one head, but just multiply that by 7 and you get a picture of a dragon with 7 heads, right? So this dragon, John is seeing this vision, and sometimes he looks up into the sky, into the heavens, and he sees things, and that's where he saw the sign of the dragon. And sometimes he looks down onto the earth, and he sees things down there. And he's like in this 360 degrees, well, it's actually a spherical kind of IMAX that he's in the midst of, and he's seeing this incredible set of visions and symbols and so on going on all around him. And so we have this dragon in the symbology of Revelation, this dragon in the sky, it's thrown down to the earth. If we were to keep reading, we would find that the dragon now gets reflected or manifest in a beast drawn out from the sea. So you get this sea creature coming to fruition, who is an echo in some sense of the dragon. And then there's another beast comes from the land. And this dragon in Revelation 12 that we were reading wars against the saints. Later on, evil or unclean spirits come out of its mouth. And as we just read in Revelation 12, it's thrown into the abyss, the deepest part of the sea for 1,000 years, so that it won't deceive people. And then at the end, it's released and it gathers nations together to battle against Christ. So that's the sort of picture that we get in Revelation of this dragon. And there was a phrasing that we got in Revelation which called the dragon the ancient serpent or Satan. And ancient serpent, I think, has to be a reference right back to Genesis, that something was going on in Genesis that was the root of this dragon. The serpent in Eden is now this mighty dragon that is able to call nations into existence, the enemy of the saints that provokes nations to battle and that will ultimately be chained and destroyed. So I'm going to offer a hypothesis for us to explore through this talk, which is that Satan or the dragon is a real phenomenon, but it's an emergent phenomenon of many people together. So we'll talk about the nature of what an emergent phenomenon is. But the idea is that many flesh minds coming together, many flesh hearts interacting together, form a pattern which is bigger than just an individual. And that this pattern is destructive, and it's a long-lasting system that is driven by the egoic pride of all the individuals who are participating in it. It's a self-reinforcing set of behavior patterns amongst humans. So that's the hypothesis. That, I think, is what Satan is. So let's explore the idea of emergent behavior so that you can get a feeling of it. I've got a few videos coming up. This first video, it's a little grainy, but this video is of a huge flock of birds. So all the birds are just individual birds. But do you see how sort of structure forms and then dissipates and structure forms somewhere else? And you can sort of point to it and you say, oh, there's something there, and then it goes away. And then, oh, there's something there, and then it goes away. It's sort of like clouds. We point and look at a cloud, but actually a cloud is just an emergent structure of lots of individual drops of water. that are up there in the sky reflecting the sunlight. There's no unified thing called a cloud, except this phenomena emerges out of lots of individual drops of water. So that's one example. Let's see another example. This is the so-called Mexican wave. It started from the Mexican World Cup football, soccer, for those of you who don't speak English. Mexican World Cup football. And you can see, and there are some better bits of it coming, you can see this notion of the wave coming through people. Yeah, this view is good now as we start to see. There's like this wave. It's like the ocean wave. And something is there. You agree? That is something. It's not nothing. And yet it's just people. So, but it's people working together. I thought it's really important for us to demonstrate that it needs to be the connection of lots of people. So I've asked Randy to do a one-man Mexican wave. So Randy, could you do a one-man Mexican wave? Like, it's not the same, right? However wonderful it was, it's not the same as when thousands and thousands of people do it all together. So something happens which is more than the sum of the parts when you get a system working together collectively like that. And I was intrigued by this, and then I discovered this wonderful, this is just a little bit of fun, this little video. I'm not even sure what these little creatures are, but are they meerkats or something like that? But yeah, prairie dogs or something. They have their own little Mexican wave going. I just thought that was so wonderful. So it's not actually important what they are, but and there's lots of examples of emergent behavior or emergent structure coming from lots of individual things doing their own little thing. And then structure sort of emerging. I love this sort of Satan cloud that has appeared with the eyes, you know. And of course, it's just a cloud with some fire in, and it just happens to be taken from a certain picture, a certain direction. Or the termite mound up at the top. And those are all little different termites. They're just doing their little thing, but some huge emergent structure comes. It's more than just the sum of the individual parts. What's a hurricane? A hurricane, again, it's a feedback loop of lots of little bits of warm air and water and cloud and things like that that is now starting to interact in a way that gives you global structure. And then the lemmings, I thought, was just a wonderful little thing. Liz says, Liz, if Liz told you to jump off a bridge, would you do it? So anyway, they're all jumping off the bridge. So Satan, my hypothesis for us to explore, is that it's an emergent collective behavior. And what that means is that in some sense, and this is, you know, bear with me, Satan is a real thing. Now, it's not a fallen angel. That's indeed, I mean, it would make no sense for Satan to be a fallen angel because the realm of heaven, the realm of God, is a realm without sin, without rebellion. So the idea that Satan is a fallen angel makes no sense. But nonetheless, when you get sinful human beings together, prideful, fleshful human beings together, interacting, you end up with something that is more than just the sum of the individuals. That collective dynamic creates a phenomenon. It's a social dynamic. It's an observable phenomenon. The feedback loop of prideful flesh sets up a reinforcing set of behaviors. It's a pattern of behaviors amongst human beings. Now, when you study the nature of emergent behavior and see under what circumstances do you get something more than the sum of the parts in the collectiveness, it requires a couple of things. One, it requires the parts to be interacting with one another so that, like dominoes, one of them knocks the next one over kind of thing. So there needs to be some interactions. And dominoes is a good example of the other thing that's missing. Once they're knocked over, dominoes have stopped, right? So you need to keep putting energy into the system for the system to keep working. And while energy keeps going in, that feedback loop can continue to get stronger, and the phenomenon continues. And so, for example, with a hurricane, the energy comes from the heat differences at the different levels of the atmosphere, the warm ocean, things like that. That's the energy that is getting put into the system, which ramps it up more and more, and then the different parts of the system are all interacting together. So the same will be true of the Satan phenomenon, that it requires interaction between people, and it requires people to be putting energy into it. And these both come from egoistic human beings, from prideful flesh. Malady begets malady. The illness I have, the disease, the faulty condition that I have provokes it in you. And then you manifesting it provokes it in somebody else. And they then manifest it back to me, and it provokes it again in me. And because I'm all the time, when that happens, it sort of grows in strength. You get sort of mega malady happening within a group of people. Judges is a beautiful example of this. In Judges 15, and this is Samson, who incredible guy, but nonetheless sounds a little bit like a 12-year-old here. In Judges 15, verse 9, the Philistines went up and camped in Judah, spreading out near Lehi. The men of Judah asked, "Why have you come to fight us?" "We have come to take Samson prisoner," they answered, "to do to him as he did to us." And then 3,000 men from Judah went down to the cave in the rock of Etam and said to Samson, "Don't you realize that the Philistines are rulers over us? What have you done to us?" He answered, "I merely did to them what they did to me." And do you see that cycle? It's just like, you did that to me, so I'm going to do it to you. Oh, well, then you did it worse to me, so I'm going to do it worse to you. And the cycle just continues. Violence begets violence. And so the energy of the system grows. Ego reacts to overt ego in others. The flesh in you will react to the flesh in others. And it will react in one of two ways. It will either react to join in the sense of collective pride. There's a great leader, powerful kind of ego that I want to be part of, that kind of thing. Or the opposite is, we can react to ego to reject and oppose it. When we see it, we fight against it, and a sort of battle occurs. In either way, each ego that is playing, each flesh element that is playing, adds energy to the pattern, and it creates a feedback loop that strengthens or destroys the original, but there's energy there in the system. And so when we read that the dragon in Revelation was that ancient serpent, the way I think is one way that's interesting to think about it is that the serpent, whether literal or not, we could debate that for hours, of course, whether literal or not, the serpent in Eden represents the interplay of two maladies between Adam and Eve. The dragon in Revelation now represents the interplay of hundreds of millions of maladies. It's just the scale is like off the charts. And so that's why it's become this mighty dragon that is leading the whole world astray. It's the god of this age. And it's this collective way that human beings are in terms of what human beings want, what they strive after, what they want to achieve. And this cycle, this feedback cycle that we had for the individual, works at a group level as well. Remember, with an individual, there was a notion of self-identity, and I was going to maintain my self-identity, and I go through being proud about my self-identity, and I have self-image, and what others think about it is one of those things that keeps me wanting to maintain my self-identity. And I've got my own personal standards, and I set expectations, and this cycle goes around. That whole thing works at the level of a group as well, of being prideful, in what this group stands for, in having a group self-image of saying, we need to stand for this, because if we didn't, what would others think? You see that at nations. We have to defend this. Otherwise, what would other nations think? They would think they could just take it away from us. And so the reaction to others is part of the story. Here's what we stand for, and we have expectation for our leaders and for the group itself. And that cycle is a destructive cycle. Just as it is with human beings individually, so it is with human beings collectively. Collective human pride establishes itself as supreme and has feedback processes that maintain its strength. The Tower of Babel, back in Genesis, was an early example of this. And there, God chose to intervene. And what he did was he severed the feedback loop, confused the language. And now the interaction that was going on and the self-image that was getting built up can't proceed. So God found a way to diffuse the energy from that. And so that it was heading in one direction, God intervened, diffused the energy, and it then dissipated and people scattered out. Now, not all human group dynamics are necessarily bad. Of course, there are groups of humans that come together to accomplish good things. And indeed, our desire is that Minooka is one of those, where we have a group of humans coming together to accomplish good thing. But in all groups of humans, we have to be aware that we're made up of flawed human beings with egoic behavior, selfishness behavior. And egoic flesh is unsupportive of spiritual behavior, and so it's easy for any group, whether it's a religious group or not, to become perverted and to end up serving flesh rather than serving spirit. And part of what defines a group is the story that the group tells itself. It comes to this self-image. That self-image is often contained in a narrative of how we got to be who we are or what we stand for. And I've noticed a number of national narratives as I've lived in different countries. It's often hard to notice your own national narrative because you sort of grew up in it. But when we moved to Scotland from England, it was really clear that the Scottish national narrative is that as a nation, they were oppressed by the English in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, and they've always been oppressed by the English, and they need to stand against the English. So that's the Scottish story that gets told to themselves. And as I say, it's not necessarily that stories are good or bad, it's just that there's a strong story, and that story gets repeated generation after generation. In America, stories are things like, we kicked out the British, this is an experiment in democracy, we're guardians of freedom. Those are the kinds of stories that we tell ourselves in America that provide something of our national identity of who we want to be as a nation. The Jews had their own national story. God chose us, and by implication, not you, was the part of the Jewish national story. And so part of that is shows up in Jonah, where Jonah is told to go to preach to those who are not Jews. And rather than try to give them the insights that would lead to them being saved, he runs away from it. He's not afraid of preaching in that something bad might happen to him. He's afraid of preaching because he doesn't want to be successful. And he goes and he preaches, and when Nineveh converts and God relents, he says, see, I knew this would happen. It's part of his national story. The Pharisees had their own story. And their own story was a strong one, a powerful one, which was, we see so much corruption in the religious infrastructure of Israel back a couple of hundred years before Jesus, that we want to be holy. We want to be a people that are holy, and we want to keep the law fully. We want to make sure that we do exactly what God says. So we will be separate, we will be called out, we will be holy, and we will be diligent in keeping the law. And so that story, which in of itself you can see as a good story, it's a powerful story, it's a powerful reason to be, but by being perverted by human flesh, by human selfishness, by human egoistic thinking, it then gets perverted into something that Jesus becomes significantly distressed. In Luke 18, that's the parable that Jesus tells of the Pharisee and the tax collector. And the tax collector who is open and honest before God, and the Pharisee comes to God to say how pleased he is that he's doing all of these good things. And so he ends up with pride that he is a Pharisee. And so if we ever find ourselves ending up with pride that we are a Christadelphian or pride about some aspect of our religious life, that's something that we need to be really cautious about, because that's pride throughout Scripture is that thing which is antithesis of God. Pride is about ego. Pride is about flesh. It's a direct manifestation of flesh. In Matthew 23, this is the woe chapter where Jesus says, woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, teachers of the law. And often we read that in a very condemnatory sense, as if Jesus is saying, woe unto you, like I call down power from heaven to destroy you. I don't think that's the mood that Jesus actually has. There's reason to think so at the end of the chapter. I think the mood that Jesus actually has in the woe unto you is how sad it is for you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. So if you just allow me that as a hypothesis, let's look at a few verses. Verse 13, how sad for you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves don't enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Verse 16, how sad for you, blind guides. You say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. You blind fools, which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? Verse 23, how sad for you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, hypocrites. You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you've neglected the most important matters of the law. Justice, mercy, faithfulness. Verse 25, how sad for you, teachers of the law, Pharisees, you hypocrites. You clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the dish, and then the outside also will be clean. And then finally, verse 37. This is why I think it's the whole chapter is a message of sadness as opposed to a message of calling down fire from heaven. Verse 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. O Jerusalem, how much I have longed to mother you, he says, but you didn't let me. You didn't let me gather you in. And the religious dynamic that was going on in the Pharisee group, in the scribes group, the teachers of the law, was one that made real conversion impossible. The perspective that they had, the interactions between each of them, the status that was important, all of these things got in the way of them being able to be reached. They got in the way of conversion being able to happen. And this dynamic led into the early church as well. Many Pharisees became Christians. They were Pharisees still. We follow the law of Moses, but now we accept that Messiah has come, that Jesus was Messiah. We've long been wanting Messiah. We recognize he's come, and so now we accept that he's come. And so you get this same flesh mindset still now starting to pervade the early church. And you had two very different ecclesias. And the story of the Jerusalem and Antioch ecclesias is a fascinating story to see what was going on in each of those ecclesias. Jerusalem was a very conservative ecclesia, and it wanted stuff done in the way that it should be done. The Pharisees were very much in ascendancy in Jerusalem. And Antioch was a very liberal ecclesia. For goodness sake, they even had Gentiles in the ecclesia. And they had full fellowship between Jews and Gentiles. And you know, who knows what goes on up there in Antioch. And the difficulty was that dynamic between the ecclesias was one that caused great pain to new converts. Paul and Barnabas and John Mark went preaching in Turkey, and they converted many new people. And John Mark left partway through this process, perhaps, and here's speculation, perhaps because he was uncomfortable that you could have some guy who is a pagan Gentile one day, and he's baptized, and now he's a full member of the church. He's not even circumcised, and yet he's allowed to break bread and be part of the church. And what's going with that? And John Mark, who's from Jerusalem, I suspect went back to Jerusalem as a young man and is somewhat like, help me think through this. What's going on here? I don't understand why it's okay. And what happened was that Jerusalem sent out its own party as a consequence, and they dogged Paul and Barnabas' steps as they went around Turkey. So Paul and Barnabas are going around Turkey, converting people into the new relationship with Christ, into a life that is Spirit-led. By Spirit-led, I mean in the way that we've been talking about, as opposed to flesh-led. And every time they leave a city, a group from the Jerusalem delegation come and say, it's really nice that you've accepted Christ. This is wonderful. There's one bit Paul keeps forgetting to tell you about. You actually need to be circumcised, and you need to take on the law of Moses, because this is the law that God gave, and it's the law which says how we can be holy before God. And Paul, when he discovers all of this, he writes this stinging letter to the Galatians. And in Galatians 1, verse 6, it's some of the most powerful language that Paul uses in any of his letters, where he says, let me just read it out to you. Galatians 1, verse 6, I'm astonished that you're so quickly deserting the one who called you by the grace of Christ and are turning to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and are trying to pervert the gospel of Christ. And so you had this tension that's going on between Jerusalem and Antioch is now just disrupting all of these new converts. Who do we listen to? Do we listen to Paul and Barnabas, or do we listen to the men from James? And which way should we follow? And this was such a big issue, it was threatening to tear the first century church apart, that Paul and Barnabas and Peter and some of the others all went down to Jerusalem and said, let's try and resolve this. And so you get this council in Jerusalem where we need to try and resolve what is the message that we give to new converts. Can you live, Jerusalem, with the idea that people don't actually have to be circumcised? And so there was a compromise established. But this dynamic of the tension between those who said you have to obey the law continued, and it still shows up in Paul's second letter to the Corinthians. So this is now, I guess the council in Jerusalem took place in about AD 50. So this is about 7 or so years later, Corinthians, maybe about 10 years later, something like that. This is still not a resolved issue. And in 2 Corinthians, listen to this language, and you'll see this same dragon kind of language being talked about as being present within the church. 2 Corinthians 11, verse 3. Actually, verse 2 for context. I'm jealous for you with a godly jealousy. I promised you to one husband, to Christ, so that I might present you as a pure virgin to him. But I'm afraid that just as Eve was deceived by the serpent's cunning, so your minds may somehow be led astray from your sincere and pure devotion to Christ. For if someone comes to you and preaches a Jesus other than the Jesus we preached, or if you receive a different spirit from the one you received, or a different gospel from the one you accepted, you put up with it easily enough. But I do not think I'm in the least inferior to those super apostles, and I think he's referring to those ultimately from Jerusalem. I may not be a trained speaker, but I do have knowledge. We have made this perfectly clear to you in every way. Jump down to verse 13. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. It is not surprising then if his servants masquerade as servants of righteousness. Their end will be what their actions deserve. So this flesh dynamic is alive and well in the early church, or alive and ill in the early church. This kind of groupthink that religions can easily fall into is both subtle and dangerous. We've mentioned some of these examples earlier on, but in one of the other talks, but I'd like to dip into them. The first of these in John 3 is the occurrence where Jesus and Nicodemus meet with each other. And you've got a very interesting conversation going on. Nicodemus is the teacher in Israel, and some have said that's the title that's indicative of him being ruler of the Jewish religious council. So you've got the ruler of the Jewish religious council talking to Jesus and trying to say nice and be nice with Jesus. And Jesus immediately dives in and says, you have to be born again. And Nicodemus is, what? Like, you know, I thought we were going in a different direction in this conversation. I love Dave Garnan's analysis of this conversation, that the subtext that's going on in this conversation is Nicodemus essentially saying to Jesus, Jesus, you're incredible. You're really effective as a preacher. Why don't we join forces? You could become part of the Sanhedrin. You could be so powerful within the church in that role. And Jesus' response is, it's not going to happen. The system, the Jewish religious system, had an incredibly strong hold on people. And I hope that as we go through some of these examples, you don't think that I'm merely talking about a particular church that existed 2,000 years ago, because the echoes are very strong in many different churches today, including within our own. So in John 9 is one we've referred to earlier in the week. That's the man who was born blind, who Jesus healed, and the Pharisees were very concerned about this. And so they're trying to put pressure on him to either repudiate the miracle or something like that. They start to get his family involved. And we get a wonderful little phrase, or a really sad little phrase, here in John 9 and verse 20. For context, again, verse 18, the Jews still did not believe that the man had been blind and that he had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it now that he can see? And here's this, I mean, it's really sad in many ways from the parents. John 9, verse 20. We know he is our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He's of age. He will speak for himself. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews. For already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That power of organized religion to put pressure on people and force them to act or not to act in a certain way out of fear of being shunned and ostracized and excommunicated is one that is at play here and is at play many other times. A little later on in John 19, we find that it wasn't only the rank and file that suffered in this way. In John 19 and verse 38, this is after Jesus has died. Later, Joseph of Arimathea, who's a wealthy guy, asked Pilate for the body of Jesus. Now, Joseph was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly because he feared the Jews. So all of this dynamic, it can be true in any church community, and it can definitely be true in our own. And it's a dynamic that when we see, it gives us opportunity to gently step out of that dynamic and not choose to put energy into that dynamic and not be part of it before. And so just as before, when we get any kind of cycle like this, when Satan emerges as a phenomenon in whatever form Satan emerges as the phenomenon in a group of people, the exit is the same as before. With us as humans, when the flesh, the Satan phenomenon happens within ourselves, we need to die. Take your cross, crucify yourself. And similarly, when it's within a group, when we see that, we need to allow group image not to be the thing that is dominating us. It's the same exit as before. My spiritual development, your spiritual development, is far more important than my self-image as a member of a group. That's not the key thing at all. It's what's my relationship with God. To the extent that we're able to be supportive of one another, then praise God, this is wonderful. But to the extent that the group is something that is actually causing you to grow in distance from God, then you need to take action. And in fact, that's how our community started in the first place. We recognized, or at least not us, but those that came before us, recognized that the dynamics that were at play in the organized churches of the day were not conducive to responding to God in a genuine way of digging into the scripture and understanding what the message of God was. John Thomas, for a while, tried to do that in the context of the existing church. And it was only when he found that that was impossible that you started to get more and more groups of people coming together and saying, we formed groups of people because we find that this is where we can promote our spiritual development much more effectively. And so I think it's really important that we each take personal responsibility for our spiritual development and then encourage one another. And that's the only way that our community has a chance of being truly alive by spirit rather than being run by flesh. It's the only way we have chance to be true to Christ. Now, one of the ways that the ego can twist that is that this desire to be true to spirituality, the ego can take it and say, okay, so now you have to be pure, now you have to be separating from those that are not like you, and it can really quickly lead to factionalism. And factionalism, we must note, is a manifestation of flesh, whether it's internal within our community or external in the way that we talk about other communities. So our goal is always, to what extent can I resonate with Christ? To what extent can I allow him to influence who I am? What is it I need to be able to allow Christ truly to put my flesh to death so that I may be led by spirit rather than being led by flesh? And in that, we work with one another, whether they happen to be in a particular group or in another particular group. And we want to be able to support one another to the maximum extent that we possibly can. So I want to step back again, and in the last couple of minutes, pick up something that years ago I talked about. I think this is probably one of the things I talked about in the 90s when I was here at Manuka. And this is in Job, the idea of behemoth. Now, behemoth is just the Hebrew word for beast, but it's the plural, beasts. The oth ending is the plural word. And yet what's interesting about this word in Job 40, is that this is a plurality not of number, but of size. Because this plural word is used in a singular context. There's other words like that. Elohim is like that, where God, singular, has a plural word, Elohim, but it's used in singular context. And so behemoth is mighty beast. And that's all it is. It's just like a big old cow, I mean, is the idea of it. Only it's not a cow. It's a coiling beast. That's what Leviathan means. It's a coiling beast. It's a serpent. It's a dragon. This is what we're talking about. And so, actually, let's look at just a couple of these others. We'll look at Ezekiel 32 just very quickly. And you can see how this notion of beast is being used in the Old Testament. Ezekiel 32 and verse 2. This is, take up a lament concerning Pharaoh, king of Egypt. You're like a lion among the nations. You're like a monster in the seas, thrashing about in your streams, churning the water with your feet, muddying the streams. You're a big old beast in the water, Egypt, says Ezekiel. In chapter 29 and verse 3, again about Pharaoh, speak to him and say, this is what the sovereign Lord says. I'm against you, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, you great monster lying among your streams. You say, the Nile is mine, I made it for myself, but I will put hooks in your jaws and make the fish of your stream stick to your scales. I will pull you out from among your streams with all the fish sticking to your scales. It's all exactly the same language that we find in Job, in that second speech that God has to Job. So God has two speeches to Job. This is when Job is finally being confronted by the divine. The first of the speeches is all about the natural creation, how God arranges the heavens and the earth, how he looks after the lion that gives birth, all of these kinds of things. God is in control. And the second speech is often misunderstood. It's often characterized as, oh, and here are a couple more animals I made. I mean, that would be a sort of cynical characterization of it. I think the second speech is God saying, now consider the spiritual creation. When I made you, Job, and people like you, I made a mighty beast. Like you and you and you get together and you form this mighty beast. Behemoth happens as a natural manifestation of human pride coming together. It is that manifestation of human pride. It's the emergent behavior of interacting prideful maladies. In Job 41, it's talked of as the embodiment of pride. Job 40 starts out with God bringing judgment on the proud. And it's only when Job sees it that he becomes willing to die. When he sees that the things, the standards, the personal ego standards that he had for himself, though he was a wonderful man, he was blameless, we're told. Nonetheless, because some of that came from his self-standards as opposed to emptying himself and responding to God, he saw then that he was contributing to the Satan, to the behemoth dynamic that is directly opposed to God and that will be destroyed by God. And so this is what finally brings Job to his knees, and he's willing to die. He's willing to die, and so is able to live. There's one other place in the Old Testament that I managed to find an example of behemoth, the plural word, used in a singular context. And it's in Psalm 73. David says this, when my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was behemoth before you. Yet I'm always with me. You hold me by my right hand. And so I see the reflection of the dragon in me. I choose to let it go. And I choose to act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with my God.